coming up on New York Now, outgoing SUNY Chancellor Nancy Zimpfer joins us in studio.
Free is a concept. It's a vision of, gee, I might be able to go to college when I thought I never would. And that free word is pulling a lot of people in.
And Karen DeWitt from New York State Public Radio and Bill Mahoney from Politico New York join us at the Reporters Roundtable.
The Democrat won in a landslide, 58%. And it was admittedly a low turnout affair without a lot of outside investments, but Democrats are seeing this as a very good sign that in similar Long Island Senate districts next year, they can be competitive.
It's next on New York Now, right here on PBS.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program. This is New York Now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Matt Ryan. Our interview with SUNY Chancellor Nancy Zimpfer is coming up a little later in our program. But first, let's take a look back at the week's news at the Reporters Roundtable. My partner from the Times Union, Casey Seiler, is our moderator.
All right, and now for some analysis of the week's news. I'm happy to be joined at the Reporters Roundtable by Bill Mahoney from Politico New York and Karen DeWitt from New York State Public Radio. All right, I will state right at the top that it seems as if the interactions between the Democratic factions in the state Senate are beginning to seem like one of those capsule soap opera descriptions that reads, you know, Oswaldo tells Sabrina that Boris is actually the father of Clarice's baby. All right? So let's
You need some kind of like cheat sheet or something to
I have a cheat sheet, Karen.
Oh, good.
I'm happy
glad
to say.
You too.
Just this week, we learned, reported in my paper, the Times Union, we learned that Deputy Mainline Democratic Leader Mike Gennaris and counsel from the Mainline Democrats were invited to come in by Albany County District Attorney David Soares to discuss the Mainline Conference's argument that the Lulus that were paid to independent Democratic Conference members and some Republican members of the Senate that were not chairs but were paid as if they were chairs,
yes,
were illegal. On Tuesday, let's
okay,
run them all
okay,
down.
Okay.
Okay. On Tuesday, we had the IDC releasing a call the roll video. We will discuss that a little bit more later, that basically says it's time for Democrats to get on board with the progressive agenda. On the same day, Simca Felder sent a letter to Jeff Klein saying it's time for the IDC to rejoin the Mainline Democratic Conference. And Andrea Stewart Cousins, the leader of the Mainline Democratic Conference, sent letters to the IDC saying, after a special election on Tuesday in Upper Manhattan, we now have 32 Democrats in the chamber again. It's time for us all to come together. Phew.
Yeah, okay. I'd say out of those three, the most important one is probably the stipend scandal and the Albany County District Attorney looking into it. We now have three different entities looking into it. We have the State Attorney General. We have the U.S. Attorney for Eastern New York. There's no criminal charges at this point or any hint that there might even be criminal charges, but just the fact that they're looking into what they were paid to be chairs of committees, that they were in fact not the chairs of committees, is very worrisome to the Independent Democratic Conference. And, you know, we're seeing those tensions play out with all these other things about unite, don't unite, no, you come over with us, no, we're the ones you should join. And but I think that hanging over at the stipend scandal is really the thing that's got to be the most worrisome for them. And that is, you know, the public can understand that. Somewhat.
It's definitely put the IDC on edge the past couple of weeks. We'll see if it actually does lead to any criminal charges. It seems, just based on everything we've heard with all these conflicting legal opinions, it seems unlikely that they're going to, even if they do bring charges, bring the hammer down on anybody. It might just be the pay the money back type thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly is bad optics if the IDC is going to have to face Democratic challengers next year, as it increasingly seems like they might, then this is something that probably will be used against them on a very regular basis.
Let's take a look at a clip of the Call the Roll video where Jeff Klein and, in sequence, each member of the IDC says that mainline Democrats need to get on board with a series of progressive initiatives, including codifying Roe v. Wade in state law and passing the DREAM Act. Let's see a clip.
There has been much misinformation and grandstanding concerning where the Independent Democratic Conference stands on key progressive issues. It is time that we set the record straight. In the New York State Senate, it takes 32 votes to pass a piece of legislation. It is time to call the roll.
Okay, so the argument seems to be that until Democrats can achieve perfect unity on these issues, The IDC is better off partnering with the GOP, which doesn't really support any of them?
And it seems like it's an attempt for them to, as they say now, flip the script. They're saying, no, we're not the problem. You should all join with us. We don't have to join with you. But yeah, they would still need a couple of Republican votes to get any of the issues passed that they're talking about. And that's the larger issue that nobody's really talking about. You still need a couple of GOP senators. Even if all the Democrats, even Simca Felder, united as a block and ran the Senate, they would still need GOP help for a lot of these issues. And you know, I tried asking all of them that this week, and nobody really wanted to talk about that aspect of it at all.
Yeah, and we'll see how aggressive they actually pursue this line of reasoning. This isn't something that's going to, or Jeff Klein does have the power to force a vote on some of these bills mm-hmm. and actually call the roll, unlike the Democrats. He did that a few years ago with the DREAM Act to provide tuition aid to undocumented immigrants, and that upset a lot of the activists. But is he going to actually try to end session by bringing all these things to a vote and getting Ruben Diaz, a conservative member of the Democratic Conference, to vote no? We'll see, but I do agree that this does seem to be more just trying to change the internal narrative. This isn't something that's ricocheting throughout the state that's influencing a lot of voters' minds. I went back to the YouTube video this morning, and it's had 1,000 views, which is probably all within the Capitol and Legislative Office building.
So it's kind of for, you know, private consumption then, I guess. It's sort of like a private Capitol intercom system, right?
I believe it's called a shot across the bow, sort of. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and then we have Brooklyn Senator Simca Felder, who attacked the IDC and said, you know, you should go back with the Senate Democrats. And I'm just really, I can't really figure out his motivation. Perhaps he's doing it just to torture them, because I think the Republican senators that he sits with are also kind of annoyed with the IDC right now because of the stipend scandal. The IDC brought the Republicans into it, saying, well, some Republican senators got these stipends too. So I'm not quite sure of his motivation that he just threw himself into the mix late in the week.
At no point in the letter does he say it is time for the IDC. He says it's time for the IDC to rejoin the mainline Democrats, but he doesn't say what the quid will be for that pro or vice versa.
Or whether he's
going to join the Democrats. If they do that, I too will rejoin the Democrats and we'll have absolute Democratic unity. It was very strange because, of course, if the IDC rejoins the mainline Democrats, Felder's value to the GOP and thus potentially the price that they would pay him increases dramatically, right?
And the pressure on him is going to increase dramatically. He's kind of, this has largely been just fighting between the IDC and Democrats, with Simca Felder mentioned almost as an afterthought in recent weeks. Well, if it is actually a 31-member conference with a 32-member conference, including Simca, who ran on both the Democratic and Republican lines,
that's true.
Then he's going to be the subject of all of this. It's going to turn like a laser focus on him. So it would make life more difficult, but certainly, yeah, he would become more valuable to both and would presumably be able to get a lot from whichever conference he wanted to work with.
What a mess. But you know who does benefit from all this? Governor Cuomo.
Yes.
As long as the Senate is divided, he's still in control, and you won't have a bunch of Senate Democrats joining with Assembly Democrats and acting against him or acting on bills that he doesn't really want to see happen.
A month ago, a lot of these bills, things like early voting, other pieces of the liberal agenda, mm-hmm. Cuomo said on Easter, oh, early voting's dead. That's something that there's no support in the Senate
for. Right.
And a lot of the activists for this and other measures kind of pointed at him saying, why are you giving up on this?
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't heard anybody blame Governor Cuomo in the past 2 weeks. It's all Democrats in the Senate blaming other Democrats in the Senate.
He hasn't even been in Albany in the last 2 weeks.
It's true. Well, he came through, he swung through earlier this week briefly, but had no public events. Very quickly, good news for Democrats in the Assembly, where Christine Pellegrino picked up a seat on Long Island that was believed to be a Republican stronghold.
It's been solidly Republican for decades. Since the late 90s, no Democrat has ever done better than 33% there. It was Governor Cuomo's second worst assembly district south of Poughkeepsie. But the Democrat won in a landslide, 58%. And it was admittedly a low turnout affair without a lot of outside investments, but Democrats are seeing this as a very good sign that in similar Long Island Senate districts next year, they can be competitive.
Yeah. All right, well, that is where we're going to have to leave it for Bill Mahoney of Politico New York. Karen, you sat down earlier this week with outgoing SUNY Chancellor Nancy Zimpher.
That's right. She's leaving after 8 years. I think, you know, one of the better things that you can say about her is she didn't get herself involved in any controversies, which is pretty much an achievement for modern day politics. Chancellor Nancy Zimpher, thanks for joining us in what is maybe going to be your final time on New York Now, but who knows?
Who knows? Thank you. You're leaving your job at SUNY. You began, I remember when you began, it was 2009, and we were at the depths of the Great Recession. Things were going so poorly for New York. The revenue wasn't coming in. You know, SUNY was being cut. It seems a little bit calmer now, though you could argue maybe it's the calm before the storm. So what was that like, and what do you think were the biggest achievements that you had during this tenure?
Well, in some ways, I'm kind of grateful that we had a challenge in front of us. I was really busy. I was busy at the University of Cincinnati and busy coming here. Mm-hmm. And it's not as if I didn't know there was a recession, but I didn't feel it until I went on the road. And so I came in June 1 of 2009. By June 3, I was in Ithaca at Cornell, and that launched a 64 campus tour. And what I learned is A, how the recession was hitting the local communities, and B, how important our campuses are to those local communities. So actually, that Great Recession framed the strategic plan that we have lived by for the last 8 years, called the Power of SUNY. It stemmed this notion that we had to work harder together, that we too were gonna have to tighten our belt, that education was more important than ever, that healthcare needed to be distributed to the whole state. So it actually framed everything we've been about in the last 8 years. And it was a good thing. It was a terrible mm-hmm. thing. Yeah. But it really woke us up to the real role we could play in the state of
New
York.
Kind of a galvanizing
moment. Exactly.
Because in the past, the SUNY campuses could be, and I graduated from SUNY, so I know, they could be their own little fiefdoms and their own little sections of the world. And do you think that that's changed?
Well, it evolved. I can't say that on June 1, 2009, I knew where we ought to go. But by the time I went to all the campuses, and then we had about a 200-people group working for the next 5 months on who we were going to be in the next decade. SUNY had just turned 60, so it was a big moment for us. And it just kept cascading in that we had to connect the dots. And, you know, we're so unique because we have community colleges and tech schools mm-hmm. and comprehensives and doctoral institutions and our medical schools. So what would happen if we could really integrate our capacity in the name of the Empire State? And I think I was not the lone person saying that. It was an aha for everybody, and we have really followed through on that.
So you started with 64 campuses. There's still 64 campuses. Is that too many? Sometimes people say there's too many.
Well, it's one of my favorite questions because for a couple of years, I kept the Up North media alive because we tried this shared presidency idea. Mm-hmm. The goal of it was to keep the distinctiveness of the campuses, but to economize around the administrative overhead costs. We launched a real big shared services, and we were actually sharing people. But you know what? The local politics.
People didn't like it.
They didn't like it. And I feel like I learned a lot, and I survived, and we went forward. And, of course, a sense of humor helps you a lot, and humility helps a lot. Mm. But someday we will come back to these ideas because we can't support the infrastructure of so many school districts and so many municipalities and so many campuses. So we've got to find a way to share. And we did launch a shared services program that is saving us about $100 million a year. That's a pretty big ask, mm-hmm. and we got that done. So we're learning how to get along better together.
So what haven't you done? I know you can't accomplish everything in the years that you've been here. Is part of it cutting administration, you think? Are there other things that you just think SUNY's got to do?
Well, I've never been totally infatuated with budget and administrative overhead. Those are not the topics that create the passion that drives the work. The passion that drives the work is completing every student who comes to SUNY, giving us broad access through our community colleges, being able to have a student transfer to a four-year institution without losing one credit, and then making sure they graduate. That's what drives what we're doing. That's what's important to us.
Governor Cuomo, he has a reputation for not getting along with everyone. How did you get along with him? You had to work with him closely for a number of years.
Yeah, I think the word would be swimmingly. Huh? I think we share a commitment to education, and by that I mean early, middle, post-secondary workforce development. That's what drives the state. I was energized by that agenda. That is his agenda. We did a lot with innovation and entrepreneurship and really building up upstate New York. So I think when your values and your policies are aligned, the different personalities that come with all of us were not an issue for us. We just got the work done.
So one of the biggest items lately that's in the news is the new program for essentially free tuition for some members of the middle class. When it's fully phased in, families with incomes of up to $125,000 can get free tuition. Do you have any numbers yet on how many students might take advantage of that?
Well, we start way out here with how many people are eligible, and then you tone that down to how many already get TAP, how many already get Pell, how many get individual philanthropic scholarships.
Yeah, there is already a lot of aid out there.
So you just keep reducing it because it's a last dollar scholarship. And that might be between 20 and 40,000 students, which is a huge number. If we could acclimate and enter and graduate 20,000 more students, that would be a boon to this state.
Can SUNY handle that, though? Because you can't really control what campuses they would go to. So some campuses might have a huge influx. Do you have?
it's exciting, isn't it?
Well, it is. But do you have the professors? I mean, would they be disappointed when they got there and couldn't get, maybe not get their courses?
Well, we've actually examined which of our campuses have room, which don't. So many of our community colleges do. Remember, people, when the economy is bad, they come back to school. When it gets better, they go back to work. So we have that space we created during a bad economy in our community colleges. And then a handful of our four-year institutions have room. So we're going to try to direct people to the places where we know there's capacity and we can respond to it.
But the student could still choose what college
they
want.
Absolutely can.
Right? Yeah. Okay.
But if they're not admitted, you know, we're not changing our admissions requirements. We can redirect them. What our goal right now is to redirect every student who applies to SUNY. If you didn't get in here, here are five other places where you can go. We don't want to lose a single applicant. And so this Excelsior Scholarship gives us a tool to work with that.
One of the more controversial aspects is the residency requirement. If they take 4 years of free SUNY tuition, they have to stay in the state for 4 years. And people have said, well, what if you can't get a good job? You end up, you know, working at McDonald's. You know, how is that going to work out for the student? Do they have to pay back the loan? What are the terms of that?
Well, they do. Yes, they do. But here's the thing. 85% of SUNY's graduates stay to work and live in New York anyway. So we're talking about 15%. And there are waivers for the military. There are exceptions that can be made. So I think this is just New York saying we want a return on our investment. And I go, fair enough.
Yeah. So they still have to pay for room and board.
They do.
Right. And, you know, talking to younger people these days, that's two times as much as the tuition.
Right.
So it's not free. I mean, they are going to have a stake in having, families are going to still have to invest money.
Well, it's interesting. I'm on a national commission that initially called itself Free College. Mm. We spent the first 4 hours of our board meeting defining free. Free is a concept. It's a vision of, gee, I might be able to go to college when I thought I never would. And that free word is pulling a lot of people in. But we are also able to use a lot of our scholarship money to buy down room and board and buy down the cost of books because of Excelsior. So Excelsior and Pell and the tuition assistance program take care of tuition. Then we have the other philanthropic money to buy down room and board and texts.
Is this going to hurt the private colleges at all? They've said we can't compete with free.
Well, I really don't know. I've tried to open my own mind to this is good for all of us. New York is a very generous state to private institutions, second only to Texas in terms of access to tuition assistance and the Bundy aid. So I think we're doing pretty well by our private institutions. And in this case, we educate so many New Yorkers. Something like 43% of all New Yorkers go to a SUNY school, and we prepare a quarter of all the teachers. So it's important that we support public education, largely because of the scale of our work.
Change the topic for a moment. President Trump's budget. I have to admit, I tried to study up on it before we did this interview, and I have to conclude that it pretty much just cuts everything from, you know, kindergarten to higher education to many other programs. If that were to go through, it's got to have an impact on SUNY, right?
Of course it does. And the two big buckets that we're watching so closely are a compilation of what I would call opportunity programs. It includes Pell, but it also includes Early Start and opportunities for students to get better prepared for college while they're still in high school, Gear Up and other really famous programs that have for so many years helped the underserved get ready for college. That's one big bucket. And then, of course, research and inquiry and innovation, which drives our country. It's early in the process. I work very closely with the Beltway organizations that advocate for higher education, both public and private. So I hope our advocacy, our voice is heard as we move through the process for those two reasons, access and inquiry, discovery, and, you know, a cure for cancer. This is where it comes from. It comes from our universities.
Have you run any numbers on that? I know the budget just came out this week as to how many students could be affected and maybe not be able to attend college or have to come up with other funding.
Well, I can just say this. Over half of our population now goes to school tuition-free, and of those who get TAP awards and Pell awards, many of them have the full award. It would have a devastating effect on access, and access leads to completion, leads to workforce development, and leads to economic success. That's the whole issue here that is at stake, and I think that's exactly what will be debated by the Congress.
Now, you have a successor.
Yes.
It's another woman. That's a good thing to replace you. Christina Johnson. I was looking up her bio. She's an engineer. She worked on technology for 3D movies. She supposedly started a hydroelectric plant.
Exactly. Isn't this exciting?
It's very, very different, though, from what you know, the usual kind of qualifications you've had for a SUNY chancellor.
Well,
do you think she's going to focus maybe on the more practical than the idea of having a broader education in, you know, many areas and fields?
Well, that's a good question because she's a Stanford graduate. So she had both, the best of the best. She had a liberal education and she was trained as an engineer. She served as a provost at Johns Hopkins, a dean of engineering at Duke. So she has an academic background that she applied to entrepreneurship. So I think the real key, I've had many conversations with her. I know that she will stay the course on issues like completion and the relationship between higher ed and K-12, but she will add layers of innovation, entrepreneurship, partnerships with business and industry that are just there for the asking, and she will be a leader in that area. So actually, we balance each other, and if you took a sort of two-decade approach to this, we've got the whole thing.
Great. So what's your next chapter? What are you going to be doing?
Well, a little undecided, but I don't think I will stray from my commitment to education, the relationship between college readiness and what universities do to help kids get ready for college in the lower grades. I'm very tied to how we prepare teachers, the whole teaching profession. Teach New York has been our effort with Commissioner Elia to lift up the teaching profession, solve these shortages. I'll be right there on those issues, and I look forward to that.
Well, if you continue to make news, we'll see you back here. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much
for joining us.
Thanks, Karen.
Time now for our New York Now poll question. We want to know what your opinion is of the IDC, the Independent Democratic Conference. Check out our choices online and let us know at nynow.org.
The most often cited reason why people have their cats declawed is because they want to protect their own furniture, which is, it's just impossible to think that you're going to harm the bodily integrity of an animal because your furniture means more to you.
As a veterinarian, what I'm not thrilled with is the legislature wanting to insert itself into my professional capacity.
Last week, we featured a story on a bill that would make the decline of cats illegal in New York State. We wanted to know how you felt about it, and 92% of the people who voted said they would support the legislation. A whopping number of votes on this one. Dr. Howard Gittleman in New City, watching on WNET, told us, as a profession, we believe it is a safe procedure that ensures an excellent quality of life to indoor cats. Larry in Great Neck, watching on WLIW, a loyal viewer on Long Island, was blunt in his answer. better to declaw members of the state legislature who continue introducing insane bills like this that infringe on both civil and economic liberties of constituents. Donna in Rotterdam said it's a harmful procedure that only benefits the cat owner's furniture. And finally, Arena in Webster, watching on WXXI, it's evil and unnecessary. If you don't want scratches, don't get a cat. We appreciate all those who took the time to vote. You can do so this week at nynow.org. On our website, you can stream any of our past programs, plus find links to us on social media, including Twitter, where our handle is at nynow_PBS. You'll find a pathway to the Capital Confidential blog, too. It can also be found at timesunion.com. Voice number two. Who is it?
Thank you.
David King.
Andrew Cuomo.
Incorrect.
What?
And our latest podcast is up. Our New York State trivia contest this time around is between Dan Clark of PolitiFact New York and David Howard King of The Alt. You can listen on our website or subscribe to us on iTunes or most other outlets where podcasts can be found.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Enjoy your holiday weekend. It ought to be relatively quiet in Albany next week, but then again, we've said that before. We leave you today with some lilacs in full bloom. I'm Casey Seiler.
And I'm Matt Ryan. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time right here in your local PBS station.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET.